Robin remembered then how it had taken another year for Clinton to get his wish. When off Good Hope, he had come back onto Huron's decks, boarding her over the stern in the cannon smoke, with his fighting seamen at his back, and how this action had cost him more than a mere 5 years' pay. He had been court-martialed and cashiered from the Royal Navy and imprisoned for it.
"You dare to come here to us?" Clinton was pale with rage.
His blue eyes, so gentle for so long, were bleak and hating.
You cruel and bloody slaver, you dare to come here?"
Mungo St. John was still smiling, taunting him with that smile and the glitter in his single eye. But his voice was low and rough with his suffering.
"And you kind and sainted Christian gentleman, do you dare to turn me away?"
Clinton flinched, as though he had been struck across the face, and he took a step backwards. Slowly the litheness and youth went out of his stance. His shoulders slumped into their habitual stoop. He shook his bald head uncertainly, and then instinctively he turned towards Robin. With a huge effort, Robin gathered herself, pushed away from the supporting pole. Despite the turmoil of her emotions, she managed to keep her expression neutral.
"Dr. Ballantyne."
Louise St. John came to the steps of the veranda. She took the cap from her head, and the thick black plait tumbled out from under it.
"I find it difficult to beg," she said, "but I am begging now."
"That is not necessary, madam. I gave you my word." Robin turned away. "Clinton, please help Mrs. St. John to put this patient into the bed in the guest house."
Yes, dear. I shall be there directly to make an examination." "Thank you, doctor. Oh, thank you."
Robin ignored Louise. But when she had followed the mule cart across the yard to the guest hut, she turned to face her daughters.
"None of you, not even you, Selina, will go near the guest house while that man is here. You will not speak to him or the woman. You will not answer if they speak to you. You will do your best to avoid seeing either of them, and if you do by error find yourself in their presence, you will leave immediately."
The twins were quivering with excitement. Their eyes shone, and even their ears seemed to be pink and pricked, like those of a pair of young bunny rabbits. They could not remember a day so wildly exciting.
"Why?"
gasped Vicky, forgetting herself sufficiently in this incredible series of events to question her mother's order. For a moment it seemed that she would have to pay for the impertinence with a box on one pink ear, but Robin's hand dropped back to her side.
"Because," Robin said softly, "because he is the devil, the very devil."
He was propped on the iron cot, with a bolster under his shoulders, and Louise rose from the other cot as Robin entered the guest hut carrying her bag.
"Madam, will you kindly wait outside?" Robin ordered brusquely,
and not deigning to see if she would obey, Robin placed her bag on the chair beside his cot. Behind her, the latch on the door clicked. Mungo St. John wore only a pair of baggy white trousers from which one leg had been hacked off high in the thigh. Like his face, his body was wasted by sickness, but there was still the width of shoulder and the solidness of bone that she remembered so well. His belly had sunk in like that of a greyhound, and his ribs stood out in a rack above it. But his skin retained the texture and silkiness of a far younger man, while the body hair that was crimped into curls upon his chest was not marred with silver, as was his beard and the hair upon his head.
"Hello, Robin," he said.
"I will speak to you only when it is absolutely necessary for your treatment, and you will do the same," she said, without looking at his face. She started with the wounds in his flank and back. Bullet wounds, she realized. But through and through, and completely healed. Then, with a little start, she noticed the other old, long-healed scar just below the bullet wound. She recognized the little white pricks of the suture, which had closed the knife cut. Her own work was distinctive. There was nobody who could throw down those even and precise knotted sutures as she could. And before she realized what she was doing, she touched the old hardened cicatrice.
"Yes," Mungo nodded. "Camacho made that."
She jerked her hand away. Mungo had taken that knife cut, when he had intervened to protect her from the Portuguese slaver. He had saved her life that night.
"Do you remember this also?" Mungo asked, and showed her the pockmark on his forearm.
That was where she had inoculated him when smallpox had swept through Huron.
"Do you remember?" Mungo insisted softly.
But she kept her face averted, and her lips compressed in a thin, hard line, as she lifted the dressing from his upper leg. Then the horror showed in her face. Her grandfather's uneven knife strokes had lacerated the leg from knee to groin, where he had probed and searched for the ball, and his crude stitches had cobbled it all back together like a man repacking a valise in haste.
"Bad?" Mungo asked.
"It's a mess," she said, and then hated herself for unbending that far, and by inference criticizing her grandfather's work. The flesh of the leg had that unhealthy putty colour, and there was ulceration in the wounds, that awful sloughing of tissue that hinted at the corruption beneath. Her grandfather had left drains in the wounds, thick black horsehairs that stuck stiffly out between the stitches. She drew one now, and Mungo gasped, but did not flinch. A weak little trickle of watery pus followed the hair out. She stooped and sniffed it, and grimaced. This was not the rich, creamy pus that the ancients had called pus bonum et laudabile. From the stink of it, gangrene was not far off. She felt a little icy splinter of dread, and immediately wondered at it. Surely there were no feelings left in her for this man.
"Tell me how it happened."
"That, doctor, is my business."
"Dirty business, I have no doubt," she snapped.
"And I want no lurid account of it. But if I am to locate the ball, I must know where you were in relationship to the weapon that was fired at you, the type of weapon, the weight and charge."
"Of course," he said quickly. "Your grandfather did not bother to inquire."
"Leave my grandfather out of it."
The man used a pistol. It looked like a single-action Remington Army model, in which case the ball would be .44 of lead, cone-shaped, weight 150 grains, and driven by black powder.
"Low penetration. Break up of the ball if it hit bone," she muttered. The man was lying on the ground, about 25 paces distant, and I was in the act of dismounting from my horse, this leg raised.
"He was ahead of you?"
"Slightly ahead and on my right hand."
Robin nodded.
"This will hurt."
And 10 minutes later, she stood back and called, "Mrs. St. John."
As soon as Louise entered, she said, "I shall operate as soon as the light is good enough tomorrow morning. I shall need your assistance. I warn you now that even if I am successful, your husband will not recover full use of the leg. He will always have a pronounced limp."
"And if you are unsuccessful?"
"The degeneration will accelerate. Mortification and gangrene..."
"You are frank, doctor," Louise whispered.
"Yes," Robin agreed. "I always am."
Robin could not sleep. But she reminded herself that she seldom could on the eve of an operation under anaesthetic. Chloroform was such an unpredictable substance. The margins of safety were frighteningly narrow. Overdosage, too high a concentration or inadequate oxygenation would lead to primary collapse with fatal depression of the heart, lungs, liver and kidneys. She lay beside Clinton in the darkness and ran through a mental list of her preparations for the morrow, and set her mind on the procedures she must adopt. Firstly, she must reopen and find the source of the mortification. She moved, and Clinton stirred beside her and muttered in his sleep. She froze and waited for him to settle. The distraction altered the direction of her thoughts, and she found she was thinking about the man and not the patient. For a while she tried to prevent it, and then gave in. She remembered him on his quarterdeck, the white linen shirt open to the throat, and his chest hair curling out of the V, his head thrown back to hail the masthead, the thick, dark mane of his hair rippling in the wind. Then suddenly she remembered that morning, when she slipped out of her cabin and stepped out onto Huron's main deck. He had been under the deck pump while two seamen worked the handles, and clear seawater hissed over him as he stood naked under the jet. She remembered his body and the way he smiled at her without attempting to cover it from her gaze,
Then, abruptly, she remembered his eyes, those flecked yellow eyes above her in the gloom of the cabin, eyes like those of a leopard. She moved again, and this time Clinton came half awake. He said her name, and threw one arm across her at the level of her waist. For a while she lay quiescent under his arm, and then slowly she reached down and drew up the hem of her nightdress. She took Clinton's wrist lightly and guided his hand downwards. She felt him come fully awake, heard his breathing change, and his hand went on without her insistence. Long ago she had learned painfully that there were limits to the restraint that she could exercise over her unruly sensuality. So now she closed her eyes, relaxed her limbs, and let her imagination run unchecked. She drank only a cup of the hot coffee substitute that she had concocted of roasted sorghum and wild honey, and while she did so she composed her mind by glancing through her notes. She always found comfort in Celsus injunctions. Somehow the fact that they were written around the time of Christ made them more poignant. Now a surgeon, the Chirugus, should be youthful, or at any rate closer to youth than age, with a strong and steady hand that never trembles, ready to use left hand as well as right, with vision sharp and clear, and spirit undaunted. Then there was Galen, the surgeon of the gladiators, the Roman who had stored all his experience in 22 volumes. Robin had read them in the original Greek, and extracted the pearls of his genius, which he had used with great success in treating the gladiatorial-type wounds of Lobengula's young men, though she had substituted alum for corn, iodine for pigeon dung, and carbolic acid for lampblack and oil in the fight against inflammation and mortification. The kind of trauma that faced her now as she bowed over the long table in the church was much like those described by Galen, though caused by a different projectile. Mungo St. John's hoarse, muffled breathing was the only sound in the quiet church. Robin tested the depth of his coma by pricking his finger with a probe, and then immediately lifted the mask of plaited bamboo and lint from his nose and mouth. Then she listened to his breathing as it eased, and found herself examining his face as she had not been able to while he was conscious. He was still a handsome man, despite the missing eye and marks of pain and of advancing age etched into his face. Louise St. John had borrowed Clinton's straight razor the previous day. Mungo St. John was clean-shaven now, and suddenly she realized that the new lines in his face and the silver wings above his temples accentuated the power of the man, while at the same time the relaxation of his mouth gave him a childlike innocence which made the breath catch in her throat. Clinton looked across at her, and she turned her face away quickly before he could see her expression. "Are you ready, madam?" Robin made her voice cold and businesslike, and Louise nodded. She was very pale, the fine freckles standing out in sharp contrast on her cheeks and the bridge of her nose. Still Robin hesitated. She knew that she was squandering the moments during which the chloroform was having its blessed effect, but she was seized by a terrible dread. For the first time in her life, she was afraid to wield the knife, and a thought transfixed her. "If you once love a man, can you ever cease entirely to do so?" She dared not look again at Mungo St. John's sleeping face. She felt she must turn and run from the church. "Are you unwell, doctor?" Louise St. John's concern steeled her. She would not let this woman suspect weakness in her. The leg was painted dark yellow-brown with tincture of iodine. It looked like a rotten banana. She snipped at her grandfather's stitches and the wound fell open. She saw the depth of the ulceration, and knew from dreadful experience that a wound like this would never heal, even by second intention. Her main task was not to find the pistol ball, but to repair this damage. She went in deeper, down past the thick pulsing snake of the femoral artery, down to the bone, the bared femur, and again she felt her spirits quail. The bone was malformed, yellow and cheesy. She guessed at the cause. This was where the pistol ball had struck and then deflected away. It had struck a long splinter of bone off the femur, and she picked something out of the dead stinking tissue with the forceps and held it up to the light from the window. It was a flake of black lead. She dropped it into the bucket under the table and bent once more over the open chasm in Mungo's flesh. There was hardly any blood. A few drops only from the stitches, and the rest of it was slimy yellow matter smelling like a corpse. She knew the risks of attempting to remove this decomposing tissue surgically. She had tried it before, and killed in the process. It was drastic treatment, which only a very strong man could survive. Yet, if she closed up, the macabre spectre of gangrene lurked close at hand. She took up the scraper, and it rasped over the exposed bone of the femur. Stinking pus welled up from out of the bone itself. Osteomyelitis, the mortification of the bony tissue. She worked at it grimly. The scraper was the only sound in the room until Louise St. John choked. "Madam, if you are going to throw up, please leave," Robin told her without looking up.
I shall be all right," Louise whispered.
"Then use the swab as I instructed you," Robin snapped. The rotten bone came away, curling off the blade in little yellow whirls like wood shavings from the carpenter's plane, until Robin reached the porous core. And at last clean, bright blood came up through it like wine from a sea sponge that had been squeezed, and the bone around the hole was hard and white as china. Robin sighed with relief, and at the same moment Mungo groaned and would have twitched the leg if Clinton had not been holding it at the ankle. Swiftly Robin replaced the little bamboo basket over his nose and mouth, then let a few drops of chloroform fall on the lint covering. She cut away the rotten ulcerations, working perilously close to the artery and the white cord of the femoral nerve. She found more pockets of sepsis around the sutures with which her grandfather had closed the blood vessels. She cleaned these out and carefully cut away dead tissue. There was blood now, plenty of it, but clean, bright blood. Robin had reached the most critical stage of the reparative surgery. She knew that there was still infection amongst the healthy tissue, and as soon as she closed the wound, it would blossom again. She had mixed the antiseptic the night before. 1 part of carbolic acid to 100 parts of rainwater. With this, she washed out the open pit in Mungo's leg, and the astringent action of the mixture dried up the weeping blood from the vessels too small to tie off. She could come out now and sew up. She had left foreign bodies in before, and often they stabilised and became encysted, causing the patient little further discomfort, but instinct warned her not to do so this time. She glanced at Clinton's big silver Hunter watch, which she had placed beside her instrument case, where she could see it readily. She had been in for 25 minutes, and experience had taught her that the longer she stayed in, the greater the danger of primary or secondary collapse. She looked up at Louise St. John. She was still very pale, but the sweat and nausea had dried on her forehead. She had grit, Robin conceded grudgingly, and that was one thing she could admire, much more than her exotic beauty. "Madam, I am about to go after the ball now," she said. "I shall only have time for one attempt." She knew from Lister's writing and her own observation how risky it was to use her bare hands in a wound, but that risk was preferable to leading with a sharp instrument into the nest of veins, arteries, and nerves in the groin. She had guessed the location of the ball by the restricted movement of the femur within its pelvic socket, and by the focus of intense pain when she had palpated the area while Mungo was conscious. She probed with her forefinger, boldly up into the tissue above the raw, scraped area of the bone. The direction of the shot, from ahead and upwards, must be on this line. She met resistance and tried again, and then again. Suddenly her finger slid into a narrow canal in the hot meat of his thigh, right into its full length, and then at the very limit of her reach she touched something hard. It could have been the head of the femur or the lower ridge of pelvic bone. But she took up the scalpel. A fine needle jet of blood from a severed blood vessel sprayed her cheek and forehead before she could twist it closed, and she could hear Louise gagging again. But her hands, with the swab, barely shook as she wiped away the blood so that Robin could cut again, and there was a rush of thick, creamy yellow matter out of the cut like a dam burst by muddy floodwaters. In the flood were little chips and fragments of shattered metal, rotting threads of woolen cloth and other detritus. "Praise God," whispered Robin, and brought her hand out, dripping with the reeking yellow discharge, but with a distorted, misshapen lump of bluish lead held firmly between thumb and forefinger.